What's been on my mind this week is, today especially, is you know, how to see the sacred in the mundane, or how to appreciate the mundane as an important area of spirituality or practice or place to wake up, place to see the what's ultimate, what's, you know, what you feel is ultimate, the ultimate perspective of your life. And when I started sitting and meditation, doing meditation practice in earnest in my early 20s, within a few months or maybe 6 months or so of doing the regular practice, I became very aware that the boundary that I made between my meditation, my mind and meditation, my mind outside of meditation was an arbitrary line. It was the same mind. And that the level of mindfulness, of acceptance, of non-conflict, non-clinging, non-aversion, that was happening in the meditation was a possibility for me to have in my daily life as well. And it became very important for me then to learn how to extend the mind of meditation, the mind of non-clinging, the mind of certain kind of acceptance, into all my activities, into my work, I was a student then, my studies, my relationship with my friends, my work around the house, cooking and cleaning and all the various things that I did. And in fact, for me, a very big part of, even to this day, of my Buddhist practice is trying to better and better integrate the experience of meditation or the mind of meditation, the mind that I touch on in meditation, into my daily life, so that there isn't, you know, there isn't a divide. So the freedom of meditation, the ease, the calm, the peace, the love, the compassion that can arise there can arise just as well in daily life. And some people even have the opinion that unless it's applied in daily life, it has no meaning. Unless you can find a way to, you know, otherwise it's just a matter of using meditation as an escape or as a vacation or as a way of having being stress-free or, you know, stress reduction. And you're missing the opportunity to find the sacred in every activity. There's a beautiful story that I read many years ago. I thought it was beautiful. Of I think it comes from the Christian tradition, and it's a story of an angel, messenger from God, that comes down to earth, and first goes to a king, who appears in the story maybe to be somewhat full of himself, kind of pompous, and the angel says to the king, "Oh, the Almighty God is deigned to show herself, himself, to you in whatever way you'd like to see God. So how would you like to see God manifested?" And so the king says, "Well, you know, I'm a king, you know, I'm an important person. So let God show herself, himself, in all the majesty of the Almighty." And so God does that and produces apparently a tremendous thunderbolt that zaps the throne and pulverizes the king. So then the angel goes to a peasant, to a farmer, and asks her, you know, says the same thing, you know, God has decided to manifest herself to you in whatever way you'd like to see, and how would you like God to appear for you? And the peasant, the farmer says, "Oh, you know, I'm just a humble person, and what I like is if God can show herself in the faces of my neighbors and my family and in the tools that I use in my trade and the water I drink and the food I eat." And so God did. And that farmer lived happily ever after. So rather than focusing on the majesty and the power of what's possible in spiritual life, to focus on seeing, you know, a certain way of seeing the things we touch with our hands every day, the way of, you know, things we contact with our eyes, the things we engage in, the activities that are so mundane, so easy to do. And I know it's very easy when we do the same activity over and over again every day to think that this doesn't, you know, to forget about the activity itself and to be caught up in our thoughts and our concerns and our agendas. And to miss the opportunity that something as simple as driving to work might offer you, or cooking, or cleaning, or whatever it might be that's ordinary, regular, everyday activity. The kind of the inspiration for thinking about this today was the reminder or the thought that one of the most mundane things that we do, regular things, ordinary things that we do every day, is walking. We walk. Most of us walk, and quite a bit. And walking is so mundane, so simple, so ordinary, that I couldn't possibly get away with giving a Dharma talk on walking, because you'd all think that this was too simplistic, too mundane, too ordinary. I mean, that's not what spiritual life is. I don't want to learn about how to walk. I learned how to walk when I was 2 years old, and he's going to tell me about walking? I feel that I learned to walk. I didn't really learn how to walk until I was 28 years old. Isn't that something? And I was at Tassajara, which is Zen monastery in the Big Sur Mountains. And in the context of practicing there and trying to bring this mind of meditation into all activities of my life, I discovered, to my surprise, there were times when I could walk on the roads of Tassajara back and forth, and every step felt like a step of love. I was stepping into, or it was expression of love, or stepping into love, or it was just love was being expressed with every step. That's pretty special, just an ordinariness of just taking a step. Can something as ordinary as a step be the fulfillment of some great spiritual reality or possibility or state, experience? I think it's very nice that if you look back at the history of Buddhism, all the way back to the Buddha, most Buddhist monks and nuns spent a lot of time walking. The Buddha spent a lot of time walking. He didn't ride on horses or carriages. He didn't have cars or anything. He just walked, and he walked a lot. He went traveling all over northern India. He spent a lot of time walking. And I suspect that a lot of the power of his concentrated mind, of his still mind, of his awakened mind, was supported by the power of walking, walking mindfully, walking with attention, taking each step completely for itself. And then doing that day after day. John Travis, who's a Vipassana teacher and friend of mine, tells a story of when he was he doesn't use this word exactly, but kind of a crazed out, hippie in the Ashbury, taking drugs. And he used to live in a garbage dumpster near the Golden Gate Park. And he claims that was his address, that the postman would bring mail there. But that seemed a little bit far-fetched to me. But anyway, he was kind of way out there. And he somehow he ended up going to Nepal and meeting a famous Tibetan teacher there, and hung out with his teacher for a while in Kathmandu. And then at some point, the teacher and a little entourage of people took a helicopter, or an airplane, into some other place in Nepal where they had some little monastery. And there wasn't enough space in the plane for John. And so John was going to go and walk there. And I think he had a Sherpa who went with him to carry some of his gear. And it was a long walk, many days, I don't know, weeks or something, over the Himalayas and to this place. And he was given instruction at the beginning of the walk by his teacher, saying, keep your mind in your feet. So he did that. And when you're climbing the mountains of Himalayas, walking, you really feel your weight, you feel the contact with the ground. He was told to do that. And he says that after a while he was crying, because it really helped him to get into his body and be in his body with his background and his drug use and all that. He'd been quite disassociated from his body and kind of living kind of in fantasy life. And that simple act of walking, connecting him to something concrete, to the ground, to the earth, to himself, to the moment, just in walking. There's another Vipassana teacher by the name of Kamala Masters who had gone, I think, on one Vipassana retreat, or somehow had been connected to Dharma practice, to meditation practice, and it really sparked her. She really woke up in some, you know, in enthusiasm and feeling, this is important, this is a place for me, this is for me to do. And but she had four children, and she was a single mom. And so she was able to go, I think, on a short retreat at some point with an Indian Vipassana teacher named Munindra. And at the end of the retreat, she said, well, you know, I'd like to continue. You know, how can I do this? And he said, you should go on a retreat. Go on a long retreat. And she said, I can't do that. And he said, well, then you have to practice at home. And she said, I can't do that either. I have four kids. I have to work. And, you know, I get to, you know, it's just too much. He said, and he said, oh, yeah, you can do it. And so she invited him home to her house to live there for a while. And he went with her around and watched her as she did things, washing the dishes and walking around. And he started kind of, okay, this is how you wash dishes mindfully. And kind of, you know, it was like a coach. Kind of, you know, this is how you do it. And then there was, she had a hallway in her house between like all of the rooms. And he designated that hallway as her temple or as her meditation hall or walking hall. And every time she stepped into that hallway, that was a place where she was supposed to practice mindfulness. Mindfulness of walking. Mindfulness while walking. And then she got into different rooms where she had to be in laundry and kids and whatever you do. But that hall was supposed to be a place where she kind of just, everything else she can let go of and just do the steps that she did, the steps as she walked through that hall. And so she engaged for years in bringing mindfulness, practicing, just washing dishes, being there for just for the dishes, just being there completely for the dishes, being, you know, it isn't so much that the dishes are important, but it's the full presence and connection with those activity you're doing. When she walked into the hallway, just being there in the hallway with the steps, learning with the art, the tremendously important skill of learning how to let things go and not have things linger and hold on, you know, hold on to things and preoccupations and concerns. But learning that skill, and it's a difficult skill to learn how to let go of things, even temporarily. And it turns out she had very deep practice through that activity. Very, very deep. The other Vipassana teachers were in awe at how deep she went, how mature she became in her spiritual life without being able to go on retreats, which is the usual mode for a lot of you know, traditional Vipassana practice. And then eventually, when her kids basically grew up many years later, she was able to go on retreat, and now she's a teacher on her own. She's one of the great teachers in America. Wonderful woman. So the Buddha walked. So the Buddha walked all over India. And, you know, he walked a lot more than normally any of us walk because that was his mode of transportation. But, you know, he walked. He had to walk maybe into town to go for his alms round, to get his food. He didn't just drive down to the grocery store, you know, and jump in his car and get the groceries as quickly as he can and rush home so he could give a Dharma talk or, you know, or whatever he had to do. You know, if you have to walk for an hour into town to get your food, you don't tend to kind of do it harried. I mean, you kind of get into the rhythm of it. You walk. That's what it takes. You walk and you walk and you walk. I mean, he probably didn't live in a culture that was as time-centered as we are in our culture, where everybody's, you know, scheduled. But he walked. And his walking, that walking at ease, that walking peacefully with each step, that walking as if you don't have to get, as if you're not trying to get anywhere. Of course he was trying to get something into town, but all of you have probably maybe gone for a hike someplace, a hike in the park or hiking, and getting to the destination was not the point of the hike. The point of the hike was to hike. And many of you, I suspect, have the experience where doing the activity is not the point so much. The point is to get it over with as quickly as you can so you can get on to what's more important. Is that something common? There's more important things in life to do than going shopping, or, you know, walking and, you know, brushing your teeth, or I don't know what the mundane things are that we tend to overlook and not see as very important, not to the point. Let's get on to the more important things. But to in a sense, to just give in to the mundane activity as if there's nothing else beyond it that need to do. To settle into, to find our peace, our place of non-conflict, in here, right this. And if we don't start doing it in the mundane, I don't think there's not much value in a spiritual life. I think in the way you walk, in the way you talk, in the way you clean, in the way you shop, in the way you drive, in the way you lay yourself down to sleep, the way you shower. And to do it, you know, not as a burden. Some people might hear this. Some of you might hear this and say, oh, this sounds like a burden. And some people feel oppressed by the idea that all my waking hours, I'm supposed to kind of mundane activities, I'm supposed to bring this kind of presence and mindfulness. I practice meditation, and it's so hard to do it there. And I do it, and it's helpful and whatever. But now I'm asked to have the same challenge in my daily life too. In a sense, yes. But in a sense, it's also the art of learning how to do that in a way that's enjoyable, in a way that's not stressful, doesn't add a burden to your life. Because a path of mindfulness, a practice of mindfulness, generally is supposed to bring a sense of lightness, ease into our life. So if you are rushing, take something as simple as walking, and you're rushing to get somewhere, and your mind is kind of ahead of yourself, there's stress that builds up in your body. In that rushing and that pushing forward, in the mind that's preoccupied with something else. And that stress has a toll on our life. It's possible to walk in such a way that no stress accumulates from the activity. And what it takes is being present for that activity as if it has no purpose beyond itself, as if we're not trying to get it over as quickly as possible. So if you drive to work and you park your car, and you walk from your parking spot to your office or your store or wherever your work might be. Can that be your meditation hall? Can that be your temple, that walk? How is it that you walk from your car to your place of work? Do you ever, you know, is it something that you don't pay any attention to because that's, you know, that's like the crack in the day that doesn't count? That's between things. It's between the important things, between, you know, driving my car and listening to the radio, which is important. And, you know, you have to turn it off, unless you bring a Walkman with you. And then you have to walk to your office, and that's, you know, and when you get to your office, that's important, or your store, or wherever you work. But the walking, that's a crack that doesn't count. Or can you see that not as a crack, but see it as the doorway into, in that moment, finding something very special about how to be alive, how to be here and present. Every moment is an opportunity to find the kind of, I can say many, I can use many different words because each of you will have your own word, but something that you can touch through your own meditation practice, some deep sense of satisfaction or rightness or being at home or peace or some experience of non-conflict. Or perhaps it's as powerful, as significant as what mindfulness is for you is a moment of honesty. It's not a matter of peace. It's not a matter of compassion or love or great spiritual things. But it's a matter of, this is the place where you're really honest with what's happening with you. And in that honesty, it feels realer than anything else. One of my early Zen teachers described how he was first hooked onto Zen. He was introduced to Zen meditation. And it was physically very painful for him. He was kind of an athlete, and sometimes athletes have a really hard time sitting cross-legged on the floor because their legs are kind of tight. And he was excruciating pain. But he found that was the first time in his life that he felt like he was real. You know, it's a sad commentary of how he was the rest of the time. But he was very much in his head, in his fantasies, in his intellect, and very removed from, you know, the concrete realness of his life, the physical immediacy of his life. And that was the first time he had an experience of being real. And so, even though it was painful, he decided to follow that path. So for some people, what mindfulness does is it brings kind of very sharp honesty about this is what's happening now. If you slow down to walk, just be with the walking, what you might find is that you walk in a hurry to get things over with, to get there, because you're anxious, or you're afraid, or you're ambitious or greedy or whatever. And by walking mindfully, you can start seeing clearly what's going on. And it's phenomenally valuable to do that. There's a beautiful, eccentric teacher who comes to Spirit Rock every year named Ajahn Jumnyan. Any of you seen Ajahn Jumnyan? Ajahn Jumnyan is, you know, he's one of the great masters, meditation masters of Thailand. Great man, great realization, great teacher, but eccentric. For a while, people in Thailand revere monks a lot, especially highly attained monks, and they often want to give them things. And often they want to give because they feel like they get a lot of merit if they give. And this is a monk who has this kind of vow of simplicity, you know, he doesn't need much. And they'd give him all this gold. Gold Buddhas and gold jewelry and trinkets and, you know, all this stuff. And sometimes abbots will just hoard it in their back room, or sometimes they'll just give it away, or sometimes they'll sell it and use it to build out their monastery. There's all kinds of, you know, the range of things. What he would do was he would wear it. And when he first came to Spirit Rock, you know, he had, underneath his robe, I mean, he looked like he was really fat. Really fat, you know, because he had all this gold and jewelry. Imagine what it was like to go through security at the airport. The metal detectors, you know, I heard stories about it. The people just shook his head when they saw him. You know, all this stuff. Come on. You know, all this gold, you know, stuff. And so if you gave it something to him, he just put it on, added, you know, all this heavy stuff, he's walking around with it. And it was something about, you know, that I'm not sure what he was trying to. He was trying to teach people something. What?
I think I know what he was teaching.
What was he teaching?
That extraneous material things weigh you down. Pretty soon he won't. He'll be walking like a gorilla.
Uh-huh.
He can't walk upright because it's so heavy. And he won't be able to give talks everywhere because he can't walk. So that's pretty explicit to me.
Uh-huh. Yeah, it's beautiful. So I forgot why I was talking about Ajahn Jumnyan. I went off on a tangent to Ajahn Jumnyan's story. What? No, before that, that was like a little aside telling you about that. But that's the way it goes. What?
He was at Spirit Rock.
Yeah. Oh yes, now I remember. Yes. He was talking about the nobility of suffering. And usually we think suffering is awful. And when you think it's awful, then it is. You can't argue with that. But the nobility of suffering comes when you see suffering, when you bring a perspective on your suffering that's different than the perspective of self-pity or woe is me, or I'm stuck here, or this is terrible, or, you know, or anger, or, you know, all the kind of attitudes we might have, ways in which we might see our suffering. He was suggesting there's another way of looking at our suffering. And that way is to look at it as part of the path towards liberation. And when you do that, you ennoble your suffering. You see the nobility of it. But you have to see it as something that's part of your spiritual practice. That you're going to bring attention to it, you're going to find your how to be not in conflict with it, you're going to study it and see the causes of that suffering, the craving, the clinging, the fear, the hate that might be the cause of it, and then learn to let go of that. And when you can see that the potential, not necessarily you can do it, but see the possibility of that and look at your suffering that way, then there's a very different relationship to it, which in the Buddhist tradition, he said, is ennobling, makes you into a noble person. Yeah.
When I was on retreat with him when he was here, he had the off-the-shoulder robe look, you know, and it would be really hot or really cold, and he just, you know, would sit like a rock, and he would never say, oh, could you open the window? Could you turn up the heat? You know, it's like, and, you know, he just sits through anything. And come to find out.
And everybody else at the retreat got sick, right?
Yes. Well, about half. Fully half. Actually, I left early because I was overwhelmed by the physical. But he he slept in a bathroom for many years to just to be alone, because there's so much demands on his time. And so you know, you think he sleeps at least in a kuti, but no. So when he's cold, he says, aren't you cold? He says, well, your body's cold, but I'm not cold.
So he's quite a character. You should go see him when he comes to town. But the nobility of suffering. So it's, mindfulness helps us see what's real. So walking. May I encourage all of you to take walking seriously? That how you walk, and that when you those times when you find yourself walking, that you might actually think of walking. When you walk, that's your temple, that's your retreat, that's your spiritual discipline, spiritual life can be realized, can be practiced, can be unfold in the walking. Any time that you're walking. It's available any step you take. And why not? Why are you going to put it off? I don't have time today. You have to walk. Anyway, you might as well use it for two purposes. What do you think of that? So in Buddhism, the Buddhist monks and nuns from the ancient times do a lot of walking, to get places and whatever. But they also do a lot of walking meditation. And I don't know how many of you are familiar with walking meditation, but it's one of the great spiritual meditation practices of Buddhism. It's not known so well. The books in English usually talk about sitting meditation. In Asia, they actually build walkways and sometimes hallways. They're specifically designated for walking. At Spirit Rock, they have a walking hall that's probably, it's really big. I don't know how big it is, but it's really much, maybe twice the size of this room here. That was built, its only function is so people can walk in it. And people walk back, you get about 30, 40 people who can walk back and forth next to each other. And so there's a whole practice of walking meditation. It's usually done by walking a little bit slower than you usually would in daily life. And I find it's very nice in daily life to walk a little bit slower than I normally would. And then when I'm not doing walking meditation, but formally, but doing kind of walking around town, being mindful, I find it very nice to coordinate my steps with my breathing. So that I kind of, maybe for every in-breath, maybe it's like four steps is a cycle of breathing in and out. But somehow keeping a rhythm going between the breath and the steps is very nice. Sometimes I don't pay attention to my breathing while I walk, but just stay and keep my attention in my feet or my legs as I walk. And it's as important, as significant to do that as to center your attention on your breathing when you meditate. There's joy and delight to be found in something as mundane as being present for your feet as your feet touch the ground. Now, isn't that great? Isn't that radical? Is it boring? It's up to you. So what do you think of that? You have any questions or comments? Reservations? Anything I said today? Or anything else?
I think one of the issues would be when walking, particularly out in the street, keep your mind shut off, or at least focused on what you're doing, because there's so many stimuli coming in. How do you do that?
That's one way to practice meditation, is to kind of let everything else fall away or turn away from everything, just keep it, your attention on your feet. Another way to do meditation is called choiceless awareness, where you're not trying to keep anything at bay, away from anything, but rather what you do is you try to wake up to the present moment, to what's actually happening. So suddenly there's this loud car driving down the road. That becomes your place where you do your mindfulness. So whatever's happening, whatever's predominant, most pronounced in the environment, that's where you center your attention. It's kind of like, the analogy I like very much is that if you're sharpening, don't push the analogy, but anyway, if you want to sharpen a knife, it doesn't matter what whetstone you use. Any whetstone will do to sharpen the knife. if you want to sharpen your attention, your concentration, your mindfulness, any object of awareness can sharpen it.
There was a time when I was particularly ill and I was taking a Qigong class. And I would notice that as I walked up the street, because I'd become aware of it as sort of a physical bubble rather than a mental awareness, that I was always kind of getting ahead of my bubble of energy. And experiencing it that way, for me, for some reason, it was like, Oh, yeah, I want to stay in it. And this is the pace I need to walk at to stay in it. It was, you know, a very visceral form of the, of that, seems like.
Beautiful, yeah. Where is your center of gravity in terms of, not your weight, but the center of gravity of your presence or your energy? And it's all too easy to have our, in some sense, our attention or our sense of presence or something projected ahead of ourselves. And I first became aware of this phenomena on retreats, where I'd be sitting very stable and centered in meditation and in walking meditation, and then they'd ring the lunch bell. And lunch is like the best entertainment going on a retreat, you know. And so I was really eager to get to lunch, and I noticed that my kind of my center of gravity of my presence was no longer in my torso, my body, but was projected a little bit in front of myself. I was in a hurry. I wanted to get that thing. So it was kind of like a little bit ahead. And sometimes the center of gravity can be behind you slightly, or the sense of it, as we hold back and hesitate. And to kind of find out where the center of gravity of your presence, of your being is, and to find how to center it right here, you know, will help you relax and help you be at peace.
I'm just starting to see that... I don't know how to explain it exactly, but yeah, like you said, suffering and imagining and experience, but there really is there's a place where it's just the suffering, and you don't get into the earthly cause of it, you know, how it happened, or the story, or the person, or the situation. That you really can, not always, or not too often, I guess, for me, but it's just sort of a neutral kind of experience. It's just the suffering. It's just the pain or the the anxiousness, just the experience, and how it happened isn't really important. And I think that's very intriguing to me, because. I think therein lies a healing of some sort. And it would be, now I'm grasping again, that would be nice to have it happen more. You divorce yourself from all the extraneous stuff about it. Just be aware of it. That's all. That's really important, like the monk said.
Yeah, I think so.
And I don't know. I guess that just comes with meditation.
What you're pointing to, one of the things you're pointing to is the possibility of having a simple presence, simple awareness of what's happening, without complicating it with judgments, interpretations, clinging, aversions, holding. We tend to complicate the immediacy, the simplicity of our experience with all these attitudes and ideas and relationships that we add onto it. And if you can experience suffering or pain very simply without making a deal out of it, it's a lot easier. And one of the ways we make a big deal out of it, that often adds to it, is we, some way or other, we let the pain define who we are. It becomes a source of identity, you know, sometimes negative identity. Oh, you know, I'm a failure as a human being because this is happening to me. Or I'm embarrassed to let people know that I'm suffering this way, so I'm going to hold it tight and you know, not let anybody see it. Or you know, maybe if I let everybody see my suffering, people will treat me kindly, or I can get what I want from people if they feel, you know, they feel guilty if I let them know how much I'm suffering. And we complicate, you know, our relationship to suffering because of things we want. And not to want anything about it, just let it be, sometimes can be very, very helpful and healing. And one of the possibilities in that is sometimes is we can the suffering will self-heal itself. We can sometimes we can leave our suffering alone, but be very mindful of it at the same time. We don't want to ignore it. You know, hold it gently, lovingly, in awareness. That sometimes, without any relationship for or against it, just let it be there as if it's going to be there forever. And sometimes it'll self-heal in that presence.
Yeah, that is. You know, the conditioning is so strong. You know, there are reasons for the suffering, and a story, and only, and why didn't it happen, you know, all this explanations, justifications, and all that, all the garbage. That there's just this, I guess that's what you're saying, that's what gives me my meanness. You know. It's just this knot or this whatever, this thing that you can loosen up around and not, with the mind, you know, the mind just does all this conditioned stuff. It's hard to tone it down.
Yeah, the mind has no shame. The mind is, you know, it's a trip. A lot of meditators have found it very helpful not to be engaged in the story making behind their suffering, because you know who did what to who and when, and you know the history of it and all that. And sometimes that just keeps it all locked into place, and there's a whole very different way of relating to it that can bring healing and peace. And it can be very powerful just to hold the experience of suffering in awareness without doing anything more to it. But I want to say kind of as a little kind of, and the central teachings of the Buddha is there's a cause for your suffering. And the cause, and this is one of the most radical teachings of the Buddha, it's very challenging and upsetting some people to hear this as a teaching. The cause of your suffering is your craving. It's what you do, something you do. So it doesn't have to do with your history. History is the condition for the arising of the suffering, but it's not the cause. The cause is something you do. So the analogy might be all kinds of people come together, and through a lot of complicated history, that you are related to that history somehow, a distant past, and someone said, you said something to someone, and they said something to you, and there was a misunderstanding, and then this, you know, and finally someone builds a fire. A little fire, campfire. And so there's all this whole history that caused that campfire to be there, you know, conditions to arise. And somebody built a campfire. And you decide it'd be really great to grasp a hold of that flame. And you go in there and you put your hand in the flame and you're going to grasp it. Now, it's a little bit hard to grasp flame, right? And if you try to hold on to it, what happens? You burn yourself. Who's responsible for you burning yourself? You don't blame the causes and conditions of all the people, you know, all the complicated story of why the fire got there. So you are the one who put the hand in there, and it's really clear that you're the one responsible for that clinging, that grasping. And what you're trying to grasp doesn't really exist either. So it's kind of like that with so there is, you know, we have to also see where the place of responsibility is for us in the moment, where the grasping is. Well, it's a quiet group here. I was hoping to say something that was a little bit challenging. So if you're challenged, I was hoping you'd be kind of, you know, aroused to ask questions. But so, yes.
You talk about making mindful.
Yes.
If I didn't know how to walk mindfully,
in fact,
if I didn't know how to walk, how would you explain that?
I would start by saying, study how you actually do walk.
Isn't that self-centeredness?
Well, so that's a loaded question. As being self-centered is bad and wrong. That's the implication, right? Mm-hmm. So what is it? What is it you understand about self-centeredness?
In self-centered, if I'm walking mindfully, I'm walking in a place that I think is safe and comfortable.
Yeah.
So if I'm looking into the way I'm walking, And how can I get into that holy place?
Oh, there's a path to that. And the path to it is to begin by studying how actually your walking is. Get to know your walking. Study it, get to know it. And in getting to know it, become familiar with what it's like actually to walk for you, what the experience of walking is like for your legs, your feet, your soles of your feet. And then learn to begin bringing full attention to that experience, what your experience of walking is. So full, so complete, that you could actually begin letting go of the normal preoccupations, fears, desires, obsessions that the mind has. And as those kinds of obsessions of the mind fall away, and the veils, the cloudiness of the thoughts and ideas fall away, and you can just see directly, be really fully present, directly and immediately for the fullness of that step, right there you'll find what's sacred. That sacredness right there. So you asked, how can I learn to walk? You learn to walk first by studying how it is you walk. And then in studying, and then once you know how you walk, then learning how to keep your attention in that simplicity of those experience of walking. Is it self-centered? You're centering your attention here, in this physical body, in this being here. In that sense, it's self-centered. Usually self-centered implies self-preoccupation with self-image, self-identity, narcissism, what I want, me at the expense of others and all that. Hopefully this is the opposite of that. This is the healing of that kind of unhealthy self-centeredness. Because as you are there fully for this step, fully there for washing that dish, fully there for talking with your friend, what you're doing is learning to let go of the self-centeredness. It actually is a barrier to that fullness of connection. So people who are self-centered can't really be fully present for how things are. They're present for how things are, but it's often through the filter of what they want out of the thing, and how the world out there is going to feed into that self-centeredness. So it's not really there for a thing in and of itself. And as you learn to do it with your feet, you'll learn to do it with your neighbor who's suffering. You'll learn to be present fully for your friend. You'll learn actually to get out of yourself, get out of your own way, so you can actually be of service to others if that's what you want to do.